we've been on the bearish side for the economy for a while and still are. And while we didn't know exactly which thing will crack, the degree of the tightening, the degree to which the economy was dependent on the low interest rates and the liquidity that those causes, some things like this are going to crack. We don't even think we're at the end of it. When we look at the impact of this, there's a lot of questions about the substitutability of the debt that was there, but about 2.7% of GDP annualized over the last couple of years has been coming from the banks that are most under strain. Now there's ways, I don't think that whole 2.7 will come out of the economy right away, but this by itself could be a reasonable impact on the economy. And when you take that combined with everything else going on with respect to the tightening, that's gonna be the big deal.
I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations. Over the past 2 weeks, we've seen the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, and fears that additional banking institutions will also go under. This has spiraled into something larger that's now reshaping the banking system, as well as the credit pipes, and we believe will have a big impact on markets and the economy going forward. In the last few days, we published a series of daily observations, pulling together our thoughts on these dynamics. And today, I'm joined by two of the authors of that series, co-CIO Greg Jensen and co-head of our rates team, Alex Schiller, to delve deeper and discuss the key takeaways from those observations. And we're recording this podcast right after Wednesday's Fed meeting, so we'll also touch on the dilemma the crisis creates for monetary policy and how the Fed is processing that challenge. So let's jump right into it. And Greg and Alex, I want to thank you so much for joining me. As I mentioned, this series was published in three parts. And Greg, before we start, maybe you can give a quick overview of what each part was about, and then we'll explore each topic in more detail.
Yeah, so we broke it into three parts because there's so much going on, and we want to try to make it digestible and digest it ourselves as we dug into the data and our systems to really do a diagnosis of everything that's happening in the bank run. So the first wire was exactly that. It was diagnosing the bank run itself. Where was money leaving? Where was it going? How was that playing out? The second part was looking at how this earthquake in the banking system will affect credit pipes going forward. And basically, there's three big things that we take away from that. One is the effect on bank profitability. That's going to be rippling through the system as it gets more expensive to hold on to deposits. The NIMs across the sector are going to be hit, and that's going to ripple through in terms of creating some zombie banks that really are have negative profitability at this level, and a bunch that are a lot less profitable than they were. The second part of that is probably no matter what happens from here, the lesson of banks and the amount of duration it's safe for them to hold is rippling through. In some cases, literally banks are being closed, and that duration has to be sold into the market. And in other cases, either through regulation or just through the lesson being obvious, you're likely to see very little purchase of duration by most banks and the rolling off of duration in many banks, which means you have to find somebody in the private sector, somebody else to make up for the fact central banks aren't buying duration anymore and the banks aren't buying duration and they're the only buyers of duration at current interest rates. So that's a big deal. And then third, the shift from small to big, the fact that small banks, of course, have been hit the hardest by the events. Big banks are getting bigger. That's going to have a flow through the macro economy because there are elements of the economy where small banks are critical. CRE comes to mind and other places where lending to small companies and those things are going to be the most affected by this crisis. So those are the three things we really dug into in that wire. And then in the third wire, it was really, well, how will all of that net out for the economy?
Great. So let's jump right into the first part. And maybe, Greg, you could just summarize what actually happened over the past 2 weeks in terms of the bank run, what the drivers were, and where things stand now. In some sense, this crisis was kicked off by a run on Silicon Valley Bank. But as you wrote, the real roots of this crisis go back much farther than that.
Yeah, kind of the root cause really starts post-financial crisis. And credit pipes were totally rebuilt during a post-financial crisis in ways that in many ways made the financial system more safe, but opened up a new sort of gap. The basic picture is that rates drop, the Fed gets into buying assets that made the ability for banks to be profitable in their old business much lower than it was. And the fact that post-financial crisis, there was such a credit hangover that the private sector wasn't created that much credit, that as banks didn't have that much to do with the deposits that they got, and they got more deposits due to QE, that they started on taking on more government bond, government guaranteed mortgage issuance as the assets that they were holding. And then that trend massively accelerated in the pandemic when you had a huge surge in deposits based on MP3 policies that pushed money into the banks at record rates. And again, there wasn't enough private sector credit to keep up with that, although private sector credit did grow a lot. That money then flowed into the yield curve, and banks got more and more confident, in part from the lesson in 2018, where even though short rates had risen in 2018, bank deposits rates never really rose. They got more confident that they could hold deposits at very low rates, even if rates rose. So they were willing to take on a little bit more duration than they would otherwise. And then you had a wide range around the banks. Some took more duration, some took less. So at the tail, you get into significant problems of the banks that, A, miscalculated how likely they were to be able to hold on to their deposits. And secondly, if you combine that with moving out on the duration curve, you got the toxic mix of the banks that you're now seeing struggle and fail.
Alex, let me turn to you. Greg has given the high-level background, but maybe just walk us through the more recent period up through the crisis today and just describe the details and the literal mechanics of what occurred.
Sure, Jim. So you get from the environment that Greg described towards, let's say, the end of 2021, where banks are really loaded up on long-duration bonds and mortgages and are financing them with deposits that yield zero. And then you got a turn in that when the Fed started raising rates and draining cash from the system. And I think we started getting a dynamic around the middle of last year, 2022, that's accelerated a lot in the last weeks. But even in the middle of 2022, you had a situation where, let's say I'm a depositor at a bank and I'm earning 0.01% on my checking account. And I look around and see that I could earn 3.5% putting money in a government money fund. And I do that. And the bank is holding a long duration bond that they've put in held to maturity portfolio. They can't sell it. They were counting on my deposit being there. And so the bank needs to replace it. And maybe they're able to do that by offering me or someone else a little bit more, but in aggregate, the system can't because the Fed is draining money and deposits are falling. And what a lot of banks did then, and you saw Silicon Valley Bank as an example do that, is go and find other forms of financing at market rates. A great example, and one that a lot of them did, was use the Federal Home Loan Bank system that we described a little bit in our observations, where they go and they pledge their mortgages as collateral and borrow at market rates. Today, those rates are around 5%. And one of the curious things that happens is the Federal Home Loan Bank actually goes and issues paper to fund that loan. Money market funds, like the one that I just put my money into, go and buy that. Mm-hmm. And so in essence, I've taken my money out of the bank that they were giving me zero for. And the bank has gotten the same dollars through a money fund, through the Federal Home Loan Bank system, and now they're paying 5. And so you had that happening starting in a trickle, but let's call it $400 billion of that switch happened between mid-2022 and the end of February this year.
So that's through February. And then in March, we had the failure of SVB. I imagine the amount of deposits that have moved from banks to other savings vehicles like money funds, is that much higher now?
Yeah, orders of magnitude. And the thing that's happened, you always had that pricing incentive, me as the depositor saying, I don't want zero, I want 4.5 or whatever it'll be. But you added the, it's not just me getting a little bit more, it's me not losing all my money. And so the amount of money that's moved is an order of magnitude more in the last 1 or 2 weeks. We can count $500 billion that's been replaced by the Federal Reserve and the FHLB, but there's probably another multiple of that where banks are having funding pulled and are needing to go say, okay, I'll pay you 5% for a certificate of deposit to get some other person to put the money in.
And that's what's been so interesting, that it took a lot to get people to start making that move, because the thing that is obvious, of course, but not many people are taking advantage of, was the fact that you could get a much higher rate on holding a money market fund that holds T-bills that is much more secure than a bank deposit. And one of the big questions on how bad this dynamic will end up being for the banking system is how many people end up taking advantage of that. Some people are just shifting from their bank to a larger bank, but maintaining a relatively low deposit rate. But the safest thing to do, of course, with any excess beyond transactional accounts is to move that into T-bills, which would drain a significant amount from even the biggest banks. in that case.
And I just have one question here, which is that money market accounts, like you can write checks off of money market accounts. And so corporates, for particularly, they have working capital lines, but they're much above the FDIC insured limits. Why don't they just do, like, I'm surprised. Are you surprised that they haven't done that quicker as that arbitrage kind of developed over 2022?
Yeah. I mean, I've been somewhat surprised, although history would suggest that people move slowly on this. But I thought with the amount of technology, the ease with which it actually can be done, that when we were looking coming into the year, and I mean, coming into last year, really, when we were talking about the liquidity hole, there's two elements of it, the central banks pulling back their deposits, pulling back their QE, but also the fact that the banks had been buying so many assets and that the reverse would start to happen, that you would see deposits fall because they would move into money market funds and such. And that's been slower than I expected, even a little slower than history, despite it actually probably being easier than it ever was. And I think that's because you had such a long time, a decade of low interest rates, and so much of the money, like the Silicon Valley was the extremity of it, but so many companies that have been formed when interest rates were zero, they didn't even have a treasury function and a lot of those things that you'd set up in order to do this. In fact, ironically, for some of them, this would be the most profitable thing they do. And so I think you're getting that set up though. And that's what's probably going to change this and make banks have to compete for deposits a lot more than they have, because people are now aware. They are setting up the lines. It's a push of a button once you're set up to move the money. So I think in a way, that this is part of the earthquake, that people are going to be much more aware of where their cash is and probably force banks more to compete with, at least compete with T-bills to get that. And that would really reset things. Even in our numbers, we're being conservative in the assumption of how many people switch. If all banks had to pay market rates for the vast majority of their deposits, for all of their uninsured deposits, to put it that way, the implications are great, you know, that I don't think it'll go that far, but it's not impossible that a lot of people move in that direction. So even in the numbers, when we go through this, we're assuming kind of a return to historical norms of people doing that. If it goes beyond historical norms, because it's easier technologically today and because people are more aware, you could see a lot more significant hit.
Okay, so you had this big move of deposits away from banks in a way that in some cases really mirrored a classic bank run. And then policymakers stepped in to keep the whole thing from spiraling too far out of control. Alex, maybe recap what the government has done and whether what they've done has been enough to actually stop the bleeding.
The thing that is true now, and we find is true in most crises, is that policymakers, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, the Department of the Treasury, have very powerful tools to stop a panic, to slow things down. And the expansion of FDIC insurance to cover all the uninsured depositors of a certain number of banks and the Federal Reserve to open new liquidity facilities and make it such that assets can be financed, that people can get liquidity, was very good at stopping a bank run. And in some cases, they didn't even have to use them all that much. The presence of those things helps a lot. So I would say the Fed can stop the bank run, but the thing they can't stop and the bell you can't unring is the awareness that everyone now has of where their deposits are and how much they're getting for them. And I don't think that they can stop a repricing of the funding in the system. And one of the things, just as an example that I look at, we're taping this on Wednesday, a couple of weeks past the initial failure of Silicon Valley Bank. And I'm still looking daily at the amount of money flowing into money market funds. And in the first half of this week, it was $100 billion. You're still getting immense amounts of money moving, and you're getting reports of banks that are having to go and get different liquidity facilities from the private sector and tap the public sector more to go reprice things. And so it's not a stampede for the door, but it's still people replacing 0% deposits with 4.5% wholesale borrowing.
Well, I mean, so one of the obvious questions that our listeners will ask is this bank run over?
Well, first of all, I want to hesitate to make any projections because it's inherently an unstable situation. And I won't be surprised if you learn of a lot more banks that get in a lot more difficulty, and maybe the policymakers have to up their tools. I think that we are past the acute phase and into the long grind of a lot of banks dealing with a lot of their funding costs increasing, and that's going to continue to cause pain for a long time.
Okay, well, that actually brings us to the second part of the series, which is focused on the impact of the crisis on the banking system going forward. And Greg, I want to turn back to you. What does all this pain mean for the banking system and the credit pipes more broadly?
Let me start with the banks. And so much of this hinges on that question you were just asking, Alex, which is how does the next phase of the bank run play out? How many people say, you know what, I'm safer in T-bills and I can move my money there? It is a very big deal if banks actually have to fund at near market rates and near T-bill rates. So I don't know where we're going to end up on that spectrum. That's why we're monitoring it. It's going fast. It could be on the higher end of what we were talking about in the piece. And that would be a big deal. Either way, what you end up with is they can stop the bank run because they can essentially give them the deposits at market rates, but they will end up with zombie banks. And this is a little bit the Europe story. Like, why is Credit Suisse failing? It's not really that tied to this, but they were one of the zombies that were kept alive by a tremendous amount of liquidity and people putting capital in over and over again. And that's what these banks will need, that they will be running at a loss when they adjust, as First Republic's adjusting and they basically had to replace their whole deposit base. They're running at a loss for a while. So they're going to have to raise capital. And if people look and say, I'm not going to put more capital in, the Credit Suisse story is we put enough capital in, we're not putting more in, then you have those banks fail as well. So they're going to have to either find capital to make it through the 3 or 4 years of losses that'll be baked in the cake if they're near market rates, all of which could be changed, by the way, if the Fed eases a lot, but that's a whole nother discussion we'll come to at the end. But otherwise, they're just eating away with this bad NIM, negative profit eating into their capital. And that the range of whether that's 6 banks or 30 or 40 banks that are in the zombie state is really going to be a function of how many people make that shift to T-bills. The second part, as we talked about in the credit pipes, is thinking through. It's been interesting to watch the bond rally. So it's been a huge bond rally since this happened and a volatile one. And is that right? Do the mechanics make sense? On one hand, there's the obvious knee-jerk reaction, banking system in trouble, Fed eases, all rates come down, right? That's the market pricing, and obviously makes a lot of sense. But this is first order going to be very difficult from a duration perspective, because if you take the last 3 years, the central bank and the banks were the entities buying all the bonds. There weren't other players buying bonds, maybe in the swap market here or there. So it's not a total black and white, but by and large, that's the duration issuance. Now, as a result of what's the higher rates and the tightening, there is less private sector issuance. So that helps a little bit in terms of the mismatch. But the government's actually budget deficit's rising again. And I'm going to have to do a significant amount of the issuance in the coming year. And it's not going to be banks. And unless economic conditions turn a lot, it's not going to be the central bank. So where's that duration going to come from? That's a big question. And we think that actually leads to higher interest rates and a steeper yield curve are probably going to be a necessary outcome of this. And then the third part is this shift that in almost all scenarios, you can imagine, small banks are much weaker. Large banks are fine. The small banks supply certain areas of credit. And those are the things that when you ask about the economy, that where it's going to hit the hardest, because a lot of the lending, small banks tend to go to real projects in small companies. Sort of the CRE market is largely small banks and such, where the big banks are doing more with big companies, more financial engineering type lending and things along those lines. So per dollar, the small banks actually have a bigger impact on the economy per dollar than the big banks. So even though small banks are 30-35% of the balance sheet of the banking system, they're more impactful on the economy. So this is going to be a negative on the economy, and it's going to depend on what sector you're in and what area of the economy, because some places are going to benefit from, let's say, at least so far, the lower interest rates that have occurred. But in terms of real fixed investment projects, they're probably hit the hardest. And so you've got this mix, and you go into, and sort of the third wire is the impact on the economy. And a lot of it's going to be this removal of credit that's likely in those niche areas, and how big a deal that is. How much could big banks come in and replace what's going on? And how much will small banks be able to struggle through and continue to provide credit in the way that they did? It's clearly a negative. The degree of that negative we'll continue to monitor.
There's a lot there. So I want to step back for a second and go into some of the details of some of the dynamics that you mentioned. Alex, when it comes to bank profitability, just walk us through how big you think the hits to profits will be, and how are you assessing who's most affected?
So I think the important thing to keep in mind is where bank funding costs were, let's call it 3 months ago, and how far they could go up. If you take the typical spread that banks finance at below the Fed funds rate, over time it's averaged about 150 basis points. They're, depending on the bank, 100 to 150 basis points below that at the end of last year. And we did a very simple calculation that if you just raise the aggregate cost of funding for the entire banking sector by a percent, something like two-thirds of the return on equity that they're earning, their profits as a percent of their capital, is going away. That's before they adjust their businesses and so on and so forth. But as Greg said, it's going to depend hugely by bank. And in some cases, I think this, I think it's reasonable to think that there won't be much pressure on a bank at all, a big money center bank that's actually the beneficiary of people fleeing to something that they perceive as very safe. And for some banks, it's going to be a disaster. And the big thing that is important is figuring out which are the ones that are going to be more vulnerable and which aren't. And on the asset side, the people who are more vulnerable are the ones with a high portion of fixed duration assets, of low yielding assets. And a good way to look at that is, what are the banks who, during the time that interest rates are rising, say the year 2022, their asset yields weren't rising at all. There are some banks who basically earned the same asset yield in 2022 as they did in 2021, even when interest rates had gone up by hundreds of basis points. And then on the funding side, you have the banks that have a very large portion of their funding base coming from deposits over $250,000 above FDIC insured limits. Obviously, we'll see what FDIC implicit or explicit insurance limits look like. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if we get some movement on that in the coming months. And those who are really benefiting from having non-interest-bearing deposits, just huge amounts of checking deposits. And I think it's pretty clear that the market is on the lookout for these types of things. If you go and put these types of factors in, you can do a pretty good job distinguishing what types of banks have seen their share prices fall by 50, 60, 70% versus those where it's more like 5 or 10%. And I do think we're going to get a big dispersion of outcomes, and some are going to become zombies, some are going to fail, some are going to be purchased. You could have a strong bank buying a weak bank, and that's how the situation resolves itself. Either they're going to be a zombie or they're going to be folded into a bigger operation.
And then when it comes to the duration issue that Greg mentioned, just size for us how big a deal it would be if banks significantly pulled back on their duration purchases. What would that mean for the hole, for example, in the treasury market?
Yeah, if you look at where the budget deficit's likely to go, we're probably going to see 5 or 6% of GDP once we get a year or two out from here. And, you know, just pencil in the assumption that in the near term, banks are not in the market or are selling a bit. And the Federal Reserve is, of course, also selling a couple percent of GDP, 2, 3, 4% of GDP.
This is through the quantitative tightening.
Through quantitative tightening, letting mm-hmm. their portfolio roll down. So you get to a number that's like 8, 9, 10% of GDP that has to be purchased in duration. And that doesn't happen. That it's been very few times that that has happened in the last 100 years. You know, there maybe a couple of times when foreign central banks were buying a lot of U.S. bonds in 2005 and 6 when they were accumulating reserves. That can make that trade, that market clear. When the yield curve is steep and a lot of players have the incentive to go fund at zero and buy a steep yield curve, that can make it work. But if you just look at the organic savings generated by the economy and how much life insurers and pensions are going to buy, you get to something like half that number. And obviously the bond market will clear, but the question is at what price and to the expense of what other activity? Are you going to need a much steeper yield curve, higher bond yields? Are you going to need other asset prices falling as people sell them to move into the bond market?
All right, let's move on now to the third part of the BDO series, which looked at the impact of this whole crisis on the economy. So when you look, Greg, at the economy, what kind of hit do you think this is going to create for growth going forward?
Well, I'd start with the fact that we've been, as everybody listening, probably have heard more than they feel like they need to hear, that we've been on the bearish side for the economy for a while and still are. We think the growth is likely to go to something like -2, -2.5. So a significant recession on the horizon here. And while we didn't know exactly which thing will crack, the degree of the tightening, the degree to which the economy was dependent on the low interest rates and the liquidity that those causes, some things like this are going to crack. We don't even think we're at the end of it. More things will likely crack with respect to the huge shift in the regime we're in relative to the regime we've been in for a decade. And then when you look at, so this is just one of the dominoes, just as you went through the UK pensions, they get squeezed, these guys get squeezed. There will be other squeezes as because you've had such a significant tightening and it's not over yet. And the implications don't just pop the day they tighten. They happen over time because people lose money over time. It's not like everybody has to reset the day the short rates risen. It resets over time. Debts come due over a period of time. The CRE market looks particularly vulnerable as those debts come due and so on. So we expect other cracks to occur, and that as a result of all of those pressures that have been built, that you're going to have a significant growth down move like that. This, when we look at the impact of this, there's a lot of questions about the substitutability of the debt that was there, but about 2.7% of GDP annualized over the last couple of years has been coming from the banks that are most under strain, the small banks and the medium banks that are under strain. And you're likely to see that go to zero or even negative. Just coming right before I came into the call, I was looking at the lending rates, the prime rate and the lending rates that that smaller banks are now offering. Like, they're raising them quickly. Like, they have to stop lending, and they're doing that by raising the rate at which they're lending. And so new debt's either going to roll at much higher rates or not roll at all. And so that could be a major part of that. Now, there's ways. I don't think that whole 2.7 will come out of the economy right away. Already it had been shrinking before the last couple of weeks, and that there will be some substitutability. But this by itself could be a reasonable impact on the economy. And when you take that combined with everything else going on with respect to the tightening, that's going to be the big deal. And in the end, I think the biggest issue is, what's it going to take to have households start to return savings rates back to a more normal level? How many of these things will cause that? Normally, it's actually going to take some firing. It's going to take profits going down to do that. And how long will that take? And how significant will those firings be? And what will it take for the Fed if you don't get the labor force to cool off a bit and get wage growth down toward their inflation target? They're either going to have to give up on their inflation target or continue to have these high rates that hurt the banking system and hurt credit. So that's going to be how that plays forward. So overall, this by itself is important. And the tightening together, we think, is very significant to the likely outcome for growth.
So the other interesting thing that I'd add to what Greg said about the way that this will flow through is, you're getting this degree of strain on the banking sector and likely pullback in credit conditions and availability when there's been almost no credit loss cycle, right? You go back through history and look at the times that you've had banks fail. The major waves are right after 1930. There's a wave in the S&L crisis in the 1980s, and there's a wave in 2008 to 2010. And those were all driven by credit and were hugely, hugely bad for availability of credit to the private sector. And when you think about what it will be like to have had the banking sector go through the stress that they're dealing with right now in March 2023, with just duration trades going underwater, and now go add on to that a loss cycle where you start having loans default and people becoming worried about who are we going to lend to, and you get a double whammy that reinforces itself in that way.
It rhymes with the savings and loan crisis more than the other two crises, in the sense that that started in a similar way, that it came out of the fact that they were built on having short-term interest rates low, deposits at low rates, and being able to lend it, borrow a 3 and lend a 6. And that was the whole business. So when you go into the tightenings due to inflation, actually, in the 70s, and you get the same yield curve, then, of course, the credit cycle came later, and the credit cycle made that even worse. A similar thing, as Shiller's saying here, is, I think, is likely. You weaken the banks with this move, and you hurt them further if you get the kind of growth move that our systematic process would point to, and the credit losses associated with that. So it could be a 1-2 punch, a little bit like it was with the savings and loans.
And of course, they are helped a little bit. Like, if bond yields fall, if we enter a recession and bond yields fall and the Fed eases a lot, it does solve the duration problem for the banks. But I don't think that banks' lending standards are going to go accelerate if you just fix that problem. So you could fix the particular squeeze that they're getting from high funding costs and their asset yields being low relative to bond yields. But if you're doing that at the same time as a credit crisis is hitting, it's not like they're going to go restart lending to the economy. It's going to be a mess.
Yeah. So let's move to the Fed now and what seems to be the horrible dilemma that they're in. We purposely waited to have this conversation until after the Fed met, and their decision was to raise rates another 25 basis points, but remove all forward guidance thereafter. Now, we've discussed that one way to help alleviate the pressure on the banks is for the Fed to cut rates. And they are facing a potential growth problem as this crisis occurred and all the tightening is flowing through. But they've also got this sticky inflation problem. So, Greg, taking a step back, how are you thinking about what the Fed is up against and how investors should process the dilemma they're facing?
Yeah, like you said, it's an almost impossible position to be in, the Fed is. And what's been interesting is how little the markets have actually reacted to the risk that's building. Bonds have rallied a lot, but the risk is that you're very constrained. This is quite different than the downturns that have really come since the 80s, where every downturn, inflation was low, the Fed was able to ease quickly, and they have. And this is the Greenspan Fed, the idea of getting in front of the downturns was a big deal. Here, the Fed is forced and already, we think, are lagging the deterioration in conditions. And they're going to lag the deterioration conditions because inflation is not going to turn down to last. And they're not going to overcount on forecasts, right? They overcounted on forecasts, got us into the problem a little bit in 2020, 2021, when they were assuming the inflation was going to be transitory and they just looked past it. I don't think they're going to do that again. And so they're going to be slow. Now, they're not going to be that slow, it was easy to talk tough and say, we're going to get inflation down to 2%, whatever it takes, until it takes a little. Like, it does take. The problem is the inflation isn't just cyclical, it's secular. It's going to take a lot if you really mean the 2% inflation target. And then you have to let banks fail and let credit go bad and those things, just as Volcker did in the 80s, if you actually want to get, in a secularly inflationary world, inflation back to a 2% target. So while I think they're going to lag, I do also think they're not really going to take the inflation all that seriously. As you can see, even this, inflation's actually got a little bit worse over the last month or whatever, although those are lagging, that's lagging data. But at the same time, a little thing happens here or there, they're somewhat pressured politically to start moving. So if things get worse, they probably will move. But they're going to move slower than they would otherwise, and probably going to move too slowly. And so really, you should have risk premiums pretty wide when you combine the fact that the Fed is boxed in a way they haven't been for 45 years, and the geopolitical issues, which we're not going to get into here, but there's many reasons to be concerned, and U.S. domestic political situation is not going that great either. Interesting that you're near lows in risk premiums. So we think that's one of the big mistakes, that markets are thinking that, okay, well, the Fed will ease and the economy will pick up. By the time the Fed starts easing, the economy is going to be in a self-reinforcing slowdown. And it's not going to simply react to lower rates. It's actually going to be very hard. How low rates have to get a big reaction is probably pretty significant, given that, let's say, to start refinancing homes, mortgage rates have to fall basically in half to get down to the average mortgage rate. So you're a long way from easing being able to bail us out of the next recession. And you're probably still a pretty long way from the Fed moving to easing. So we've got a long way to go in this cycle. People that were looking at the last 4 months and the decline in the inflation stats over that period and the holding up of growth stats, we think that was overly optimistic. And we're probably in the part where you're now going to see a more pronounced slowdown in the economy. And while inflation will likely fall, it'll probably fall at a slower rate than the Fed hopes. And it's going to go on for a while, and the recession is going to probably be pretty significant.
So that is, a very cheery outlook. But Alex, let me just close with you and talk a little bit about that kind of scenario and what the markets are discounting. Greg is talking about very tight risk premiums. We see interest rates discounting a total change from where they were before. We don't see equity markets repricing in the same way. So walk us through a little bit about how you're seeing this scenario play out with regard to where markets are currently priced.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. If people in the future look back at the stock market through this, they wouldn't notice that there was a banking crisis at all. The stock market is basically flat, it's slightly up on the year, and it's more or less flat since this whole thing started, outside of obviously the banking sector. And I think a fair reading is that the only reason that it's flat is that the two-year bond yield has fallen more than 100 basis points in 2 weeks. This has to be one of the fastest moves in short rates that we've basically ever seen. And I think that the equity valuations that we're seeing are more or less conditioned with the Fed moving in that direction and easing pretty substantially over the next year and a half. And my view is that if they do that, your inflation outcomes are not going to be the outcomes that they want. And so I think it's right to visualize the Fed as stuck between a situation where lowering rates causes that to happen to inflation and raising rates makes the banking situation a lot worse. And in that case, you know, stopping and seeing where things end up feels like the reasonable choice to do, right? Do maybe another rate hike or two. And I don't want to be overly precise about that, but see how the data starts evolving. And the risk that you have is that, for the markets at least, is that just doing nothing, just keeping policy where it is, which is historically tight, right? We still have raised interest rates by 500 basis points. Doing that is taking out a support, just not easing as is discounted in the rate market, is taking out a huge support that is baked into equity pricing at this point.
All right. I think we'll leave it there. Greg and Alex, thank you so much for being here. And I look forward to checking in with you both again real soon.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. Pleasure as always.